So tonight we're in Daniel chapter 7. And Daniel chapter 7, if you look at the very first verse, actually takes place a number of years before chapter 5. So this is in the first year of Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was killed by the Medo-Persians at the end of chapter 5. So these last chapters of Daniel are not necessarily in chronological order. So chapter 7 takes place before chapter 5, and chapter 8 takes place before chapter 5. And then we get back into chronological order. Chapter 9 would take place probably in the same year as chapter 5, and then chapter 10 would take place, 10, 11, and 12 would take place a couple years later. So in chapter 7, Daniel is given a vision again of the future, the next set of kingdoms that are going to arise. You've got from chapter 2, Babylon and Medo-Persia and Greece and Rome, and then that future aspect of the Roman Empire. So chapter 7 is very similar to chapter 2. God gave chapter 2 to Nebuchadnezzar and then gave it to Daniel to interpret. Here, Daniel is given this vision on his own here. And so he says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed, and he wrote the dream down and related the following summary. So I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And usually when you see the four winds of heaven and the stirring up of the great sea, or terms like many waters and whatnot, it's a symbolic representation of the nations. And let me just give you a couple of examples for that. In Revelation 17, you've got the harlot, and it says, the angel says to John in 17:1, come here and I will show you the great harlot who sits on many waters. And if you jump down to verse 15, he defines what he means by the many waters. The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So when Daniel is seeing the great sea stirred up, he's actually seeing this turmoil among the nations. And God portrays that as the sea in a storm. In Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah sees something similar to this. Not chapter 6, chapter 8, verse 6. He says, inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah and rejoice in Rezin and the son of Remaliah, now therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring upon them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates. Now he's not talking about the literal Euphrates River flooding hundreds of miles south into Israel. He says, the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, the king of Assyria. So here the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates is defined as the Assyrians. In Jeremiah 46, and verse 7, he says, who is this that rises like the Nile And then he defines that in verse 8, Egypt rises like the Nile, even like the rivers whose waters surge about. In chapter 47, he talks about verse 2, behold, waters are going to rise from the north and become an overflowing torrent and overflow the land and all its fullness and whatnot. And he's talking about the Babylonians. Okay, so here in Daniel, when he's talking about in his dream, he sees this, the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. He's seeing this turmoil among the nations. And then he sees these four beasts that are representing these nations. One interesting thought, in Revelation 13, the first verse, Satan is standing on the sea or on the shore looking out toward the sea, and he sees coming up out of the sea the beast, the Antichrist, which is why I believe that, you know, when he portrays the beast as coming up out of the sea, he's portraying the beast as coming up from the nations other than Israel. And when he turns around and he sees the false prophet coming from the land, the false prophet would be coming from Israel, whereas the beast is coming from the nations. Just an interesting thought. So Daniel sees four great beasts coming up from the sea, different from one another. And so here's a picture of Daniel lying on his bed, and he's got these four beasts in his dream. And the lion, the bear, the leopard, and then the dreadful, terrifying beast, which I'm curious to see how you've portrayed. So the first beast that he sees is the lion, and he says it had wings like an eagle. And when you see depictions of Babylon, Babylon, the gates around the royal palaces were actually winged lions. So when Daniel sees this, I think he knew instinctively what this winged lion represented. It represented Babylon. And later on in this vision, he's going to get the interpretation. So I'm not going to go too much into the interpretation just yet. And so this winged lion, Daniel kept looking, and eventually its wings were plucked and it was lifted from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a human mind was given to it. And I think that action where its wings are plucked and he's made to stand up and a human mind is given to it kind of portray what happened to Nebuchadnezzar back in chapter 4, where his power was plucked away and he was made into a beast and made to dwell with the beasts of the field until 7 years passed, and finally he came to his senses, his mind returned, and he finally acknowledged God. So Daniel sees this in this vision. And then the second beast, he says, was resembling a bear. And the bear was raised up on one side, so this is a lopsided bear. And the bear represents the Medo-Persians. If you go over to Isaiah 13, verse 17, and keep in mind, when Isaiah's writing this, Babylon wasn't even a power. When Isaiah is writing these prophecies, the Assyrians were in power. And the Babylonians wouldn't come for another at least 100 years. And then 70 years later would come the Medes and the Persians. So Isaiah's writing this at least 170 years before the Medes and Persians were even something to contend with. And he says in Isaiah 13:7, behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against them. And he's talking about them being Babylon, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold. Their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children. And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. So Daniel is seeing the Medo-Persian Empire as this ferocious bear that doesn't let anything stand in its way. And it attacks. And it's going to attack the Babylonian Empire. And he says it was raised up on one side. So this is kind of a lopsided bear. And here's my lopsided bear, sorta. And the reason it's lopsided is because of the two empires that were a part of it. You had the Medes and the Persians. And if you remember from chapter 2, and we're going to see this again in chapter 8, the Persians were the stronger of the two empires. The Persians came up last after the Medes, but they were stronger than the Medes. And so this bear is kind of lopsided, signifying the lopsidedness of the empire, the Medes being weaker than the Persians. And then he says, it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. Daniel nowhere defines what the three ribs stand for. And there's lots of guesses and speculations and suggestions. One of the suggestions is that the three ribs represented the Medo-Persian Babylonian Empire. I honestly, I'm not convinced of that, but I don't know what the three ribs are. And there's a voice that says to the bear, arise, devour much meat. So after it defeats the Medo-Persian, or after the bear devours the Babylonian Empire, it doesn't stop there. It just keeps on pushing farther west and continues into North Africa and continues into Asia Minor, and even attempts to devour Greece, but that turns out pretty badly. In chapter 8, you're going to see the Medo-Persian Empire again, and it's going to be the ram in chapter 8. And then he sees a third beast, verse 6. After this one, I kept looking, and behold, another one, a leopard. And when you think of a leopard, you think of something that is really fast. So here's a really pixelated picture of a leopard. But not only is the leopard fast, it says he had four wings on its back. So this leopard is portrayed as not only swift on the ground, but swift in the air. And in chapter 8, he's portrayed as the Greek Empire is portrayed as a shaggy goat that is moving so fast, it doesn't even touch the ground. So when you picture this leopard and it's got wings, it's just flying through its conquests. And the fact of the matter is, Alexander the Great had conquered pretty much all of the known world by the time he was in his early 30s, and then he died. So that's how fast this is. But the leopard doesn't just have four wings, it had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So here's this four-headed leopard, and in chapter 8, it's described as a shaggy goat with four horns. And in chapter 11, and here's where I want you to look. Take a look at chapter 11, because he talks about the Greek Empire again. And in verse 3, he says, a mighty king will arise. So he's talking about the realm of Greece. A mighty king will arise. This is Alexander the Great. He will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. As soon as he's risen, his kingdom will be parceled out to the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants. His descendants, his sons, were assassinated. And Alexander the Great's empire was given over to four of his generals. So that's the four heads here. That's the four points of the compass in chapter 11. That's the four horns you're going to see again in chapter 8. And those four generals, Lysimachus took over Thrace, Bithynia, and Asia Minor. So Lysimachus took over what is now modern-day Turkey. And Cassander took over what is modern Greece, as well as some of the northern countries like Macedonia and Dalmatia. But the two guys that we're going to be concerned with as we move on in Daniel are Seleucus, who took over Syria, Babylon, and pretty much everything to the east, all the way to Egypt. And then Ptolemy, who took over Egypt and parts of Palestine and chunks of Arabia. And the Seleucid dynasty and the Ptolemaic dynasty, that's all about chapter 11. Chapter 11 is the battles and the wars and the conflicts between the kings of the north, the Seleucids, and the kings of the south. And they're two of the two heads that Daniel sees here in chapter 7. So after this, so you've got this succession of empires. You got the Babylonian Empire portrayed as the winged lion. You've got the Medo-Persian Empire portrayed as the lopsided bear. You've got the Greek Empire portrayed as the four-headed, four-winged leopard. And then the next empire historically is Rome. But he's not given a specific animal designation. So in verse 7, he says, after this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful, terrifying, extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. But we're not told what the beast was. So let me show you some of my pictures that I hijacked off the internet. Here's, and all of them, well, a number of them, for some reason, look like Tyrannosaurus Rexes. So here's this guy. Here's this guy that kind of looks like a winged dragon. Here's, I'm not even sure what that is. It's kind of like a leopard with a lion's head and multiple mouths and armor. But anyway, that's what they look like. And here are a few other portrayals of that. Here's one where he's portrayed as this kind of dinosaur looking creature. Here's one where he looks like a Tyrannosaurus Rex with horns. Here's one, yeah, just strange. Anyway, so he sees this fourth beast. He can't come up with a description of it. It's just, it's dreadful, it's terrifying, it's extremely strong, it's got iron teeth, and when it started its rampage, it devoured, crushed, and trampled down everything that was before it. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Right there in the middle of verse 7, we enter that gap again. Remember, we talked about the gap when we were talking about chapter two between the iron legs and the feet. The iron legs represented Rome, whereas the feet were crushed by the messianic coming, the coming messianic kingdom. So the feet were distinct from the legs, and there was a multi-millennial gap between them. The same is true here in verse 7. You've got everything up to toward the end of the verse is fulfilled historically in the Roman Empire. But the moment we start talking about the 10 horns, that's later. And we know that because the horns are defeated again by the coming Messiah. Just like the feet, there was a gap between the feet and the legs in chapter 2, and the feet were defeated by the coming Messiah. The horns are distinct from the beast because the horns are defeated by the coming Messiah. And we'll look at those horns a little bit later on when we get to toward the end of the chapter when Daniel wants the interpretation. And he says, while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. So here's the little horn. Not so little, but and behold, this horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. So you've got the 10 horns, and out from the midst of them, another horn springs up, a little horn. Now, there are two little horns in Daniel. They are not the same. And this is where you have to pay attention to the context. The little horn in chapter 7 comes from the fourth beast, which represents the Roman Empire, or a future aspect of the Roman Empire. The little horn in chapter 8 comes from the shaggy goat, which represents the Greek Empire. So they're two totally different horns arising from two totally different empires. So don't confuse the little horn of chapter 7 with the little horn of chapter 8. And I'll just tell you what it is. The little horn in chapter 7 represents the Antichrist. The little horn in chapter 8 represents Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who is kind of an Antichrist wannabe. So if somebody asks you, what do you think the little horn is in Daniel chapter or in the book of Daniel? You have to ask them which chapter. In chapter 7, the little horn's the Antichrist coming out of a future aspect of the Roman Empire. In chapter 8, the little horn is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes coming out of the Greek Empire. Chapter 8's already fulfilled. Chapter 7 is awaiting fulfillment. So keep those little horns separate. Now, we'll get into more of the interpretation beginning in verse 15. So right in the middle of all of these beasts, so he's seen the winged lion, he's seen the lopsided bear, he's seen the four-headed, four-winged leopard, he's seen the dreadful, terrifying beast, and the little horn and the 10 horns, and right in the middle, the vision is kind of interrupted. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. The Ancient of Days here is a reference to the Father. And if you remember in Revelation chapters 4 and 5, where it portrays God seated on the throne, that again is the Father. In Revelation, you've got the Lord Jesus coming up to the Father to receive the seven-sealed scroll. Here, you've got the Lord Jesus, the Son of Man, coming up to the Ancient of Days. So the Ancient of Days is the one seated on the throne, and his vesture was like white snow, the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were burning fire. So this isn't an ordinary throne. This is a throne very similar to Ezekiel's chariot throne that he portrays God seated on in the first two chapters of Ezekiel, where you've got the cherubim surrounding the throne and the wheels within the wheels. So this is a chariot throne, and the throne is ablaze in flames, its wheels are on fire, and the Ancient of Days is sitting among the flames. It'd be really kind of cool to see. And a river, a fire, is flowing and coming out from before the throne. When we see all of these flames in Scripture, the first thing that should come to mind is the glory of God and the judgment of God. So fire is typically a symbol of judgment. And for example, in Hebrews chapter 12, our God is a consuming fire. That's the picture here. So you've got the Ancient of Days seated on this blazing throne, wheels on fire, river of fire coming from it, and thousands upon thousands are attending him, myriads upon myriads are standing before him. Really good portrayal of the Revelation 5, myriads and myriads and thousands of angels. The court sat, the books were opened. Judgment's going to fall. So all of these flames are a portrayal of the coming judgment that God is going to exact on the earth. And I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. So here you've got this horn. He's just uttering these boastful words and blasphemies against God. And we're going to look at that in a moment in Revelation. And finally, I kept looking, and the beast was slain. So the empire of the little horn destroyed. Its body is destroyed, given over to the burning fire. The rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time, and then it's gone as well. And he says, I kept looking. So he keeps on looking and seeing all of these additional revelations. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And that's such an important verse, because that's exactly the passage that Jesus uses in a couple of places in Matthew. So if you turn to Matthew chapter 24, where he's talking about the end times, Matthew 24, 29, he begins, and this verse actually gives us a time frame for when the events in this passage in Daniel are going to take place. Matthew 24, 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days. So the tribulation ends with this event. The sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. So Daniel is actually seeing the second coming of Christ. In Matthew 26, when Jesus is before the religious leaders, and in this case, he's before Caiaphas and the council. And up to this point, he hasn't said a word to the priests. And they've been bringing in false witnesses, trying to accuse him, and the false witnesses are contradicting one another. And the high priest in verse 62 says, "Don't you answer? What is it that these men are testifying about you?" And Jesus kept silent. There was no reason for him to say anything. And then the high priest said, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us whether you're the Christ, the Son of God." And I think we've talked about this before. The moment the high priest uttered those three words, "I adjure you," he kicked in the law of Leviticus 5, which forced Jesus to testify. Jesus could no longer legally remain silent. Had he remained silent after those three words, he would have sinned and broke the Levitical law. So he says, he quotes Daniel, "You've said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." So Daniel is actually seeing the coming of the Son of Man, the second coming of Christ. And so in verse 13, he says, I saw one like a Son of Man was coming. He came up to the Ancient of Days, was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. So right with the second coming of Christ, soon after that, is the establishment of the millennial kingdom and the defeat of all of these other empires. All the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Take a look at Revelation 11. And verse 15, this is the seventh trumpet. The seventh trumpet coincides, the seventh trumpet and the sixth seal and the seventh bowl are all the same event. They're the second coming of Christ beginning the day of the Lord. So at the second coming, verse 15, he says, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever." So this is the kingdom of Christ. Verse 18 or verse 17, "We give you thanks, O Lord God, the Almighty, who are and who were, because you have taken your great power and have begun to reign. The nations were enraged. Your wrath came and the time came for the dead to be judged," and so on and so forth. In Revelation 19, verse 15, here you've got again the second coming of Christ. "From his mouth comes a sharp sword so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty." So Daniel is seeing all of this. And so beginning in verse 15, Daniel kind of distressed. These dreams are a bit nightmarish. And so he says, "My spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me." So in his vision, he approached one of those who were standing by, probably an angel, and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. And so he told me and made known to me the interpretation. "These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will rise from the earth." Okay, well, we know that. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then a future aspect of the Roman Empire. The saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come, the millennial kingdom. So, okay, he gets that, but he's still, that fourth beast is kind of freaking him out, and I got to know about this. So I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, teeth of iron, claws of bronze, devoured, crushed, trampled down the remainder with his feet, the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn, which came up, and before which three fell, namely the horn that had eyes. And I've got a picture of that here as well. So here's the little horn coming up, and here's the three horns that it knocked out. And I need to know this. What are these 10 horns? Well, he kind of gets an explanation. So he says, I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. So this little horn, which is the Antichrist, is waging war with the saints and overpowering them. Now, if you turn to Revelation 13, keep that phrase in your mind, waging war with the saints and overpowering them. Here is the revelation of the Antichrist as the beast out of the sea. And it says, verse 13, there was given to him a mouth uttering great arrogant words and blasphemies. Those are those great words that he was uttering back in Daniel. An authority to act for 42 months. That's 3.5 years. He opened his mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, those who dwell in heaven. Now here's the key phrase. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. That's exactly what Daniel says. That little horn is going to make war with the saints and overcome them. All right? Then he says he's going to do this until the Ancient of Days came and judgment is passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So the millennial kingdom is going to start there. So he said the fourth beast, which you saw, is a fourth kingdom on the earth. Okay, it's going to be the Roman Empire in the right after the Greeks, but then there's going to be this future aspect that is going to have 10 horns. And it's going to be different from all the others. It's going to devour the earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. Okay? So 10 kings. Now, again, go back to Revelation. Keep in mind, Daniel and Revelation, if you're going to study one, you've got to study the other, because they interpret one another. If you don't understand something in Daniel, go to Revelation. If you don't understand something in Revelation, go to Daniel. So they interpret one another. So in Revelation 13, you've got the dragon, who is Satan, and you've got the beast out of the sea. And I want you to pay attention to their heads. So the dragon, chapter 12 is the dragon. Chapter 12, verse 13, the dragon has 7 heads and 10 horns. Okay. Chapter 13, the beast out of the sea, verse 1, has 10 horns and 7 heads. Okay. If you jump over to chapter 17, we actually find out what the horns are, just like Daniel. So he says, verse 9, the seven heads represent seven kings and their seven successive kings. In other words, they come one after another. And given what John is talking about here and the tenor of his book, John is talking about seven successive kings in relation to the nation of Israel. So you've got Egypt was the first in relation to Israel, then Assyria, then Babylon, then Medo-Persia, then Greece, then Rome, and then you've got this future element of the Roman Empire. So notice he says five have fallen. So five of the kings, when Daniel writes, have fallen. Egypt's gone, Assyria's gone, Babylon's gone, Medo-Persia's gone, Greece is gone. Okay. He says in verse 10, one is, well, that's Rome. They're still there when John writes this. And the other is yet to come. That would be the future kingdom of the Antichrist. And he says, when he comes, he must remain a little while. The beast, which was and is not, is himself also an eighth. That is one of the seven. So the beast is the seventh head who transforms into an eighth head, another even more wicked kingdom. So the heads on the dragon and on the beast out of the sea are seven successive kingdoms, one after the other. But then he says in verse 12, the 10 horns are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom. In other words, they're not 10 successive kings, they're 10 contemporaneous kings. They reign at the same time. So the 10 horns in Daniel 7, the 10 horns on the dragon, the 10 horns on the beast out of the sea, they're 10 kings. And they receive his authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. And the beast here is that little horn that comes up among them and rips out three of them. And they have one purpose. They give their power and authority to the beast. So these 10 contemporaneous kings that are reigning at the same time as the Antichrist, three of them get deposed when he comes on the scene. And so the remaining seven give their power and their authority to him to do whatever he wants. And that's what Daniel is seeing here. So he says, Daniel 7:24, the 10 horns are 10 kings, contemporaneous kings. And another will rise after them. He'll be different. He'll subdue three. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest one. So he's going to this little horn, the Antichrist. Revelation 13 talks about him blaspheming God, speaking out against the Most High, wearing down the saints. They're given over to, he makes war with them, he overpowers them, and he will intend to make alterations in time and law. And what he's going to do when we get to chapter nine, this little horn is portrayed as the prince who is to come. He's the one who makes the covenant with the Jews for 7 years. And then in the middle, after 3.5 years, he breaks the covenant, declares himself to be God, according to Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2, and demands worship. And Daniel says here in verse 25, they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. And there are multiple time references. So here he's using times, time, and half a time. In chapter 12, verse 7, he uses that same time reference. And it's a reference to 3.5 years. Times, 2 years, or time, 1 year, times, 2 year, half a time, half a year, so 3.5 years. And you've got that same 3.5 year reference in Revelation 11, 12, and 13, 5. He talks about 42 months. In Revelation 11, 3, he talks about 1260 days. And keep in mind there, 1260 days, that's 42 months on a lunar calendar. Revelation 9:27, the middle of the 7 years, that's 3.5 years. So you've got six time references all referring to this 3.5 year period. And so he's going to have gain control, wear down the saints of the highest one for the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. He's going to be around the entire 7 years, but it's not going to be until the last 3.5 that everything goes haywire. And then when the 3.5 years are over, the court will sit for judgment. His dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. And I like the way John in Revelation portrays that. If you jump over to Revelation 19, where Daniel says his dominion is taken away, destroyed, and annihilated forever, John says in 19:20, the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet, and these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. So it's kind of like these two hands come down out of heaven and pick these two guys up by the nape of the neck and just toss them alive into the lake of fire. Daniel kind of just summarily, yeah, his dominion's taken away, annihilated, destroyed forever. And then the sovereignty, the dominion, the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. That's the establishment of the millennial kingdom. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom. All the dominions will serve him and obey him. And then Daniel says, at this point, the revelation ended, and my thoughts were greatly alarming me. My face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself because who was going to believe me? So Daniel chapter 7 is very much, here's some pictures that kind of put chapter 2 and 7 together. Very much like chapter 2. So the head of gold is represented by the lion with the wings. The chest and arms of silver, that's the lopsided bear, Medo-Persia. The belly and thighs of bronze, that's the four-headed, four-winged leopard, Greece. And the legs of iron, that's Rome. And the feet of iron and clay, that would be the 10 heads. Here's another portrayal of that. So this one breaks down that final empire. So Daniel, twice in his book, gives us a portrayal of world history as it relates to Israel. From the time of Babylon through to the time of the Antichrist. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, and then Israel is gone. They've been set aside by God. They've been dispersed among the nations. And then with the beginning of the final form of the empire, the feet of iron and clay and the 10 horns and whatnot, Israel comes back into play, and that's where the empire of the Antichrist comes in, which is crushed, the feet are crushed, and the little horn is plucked up, annihilated, destroyed forever, and then the millennial kingdom is established. So Daniel portrays twice in his book a very unique picture of world history. as it relates to the Jews. But when we get into chapter 11, it's going to get even more detailed, and he's going to relate world history as it relates specifically to the Greek Empire and how the Greeks affected the Jews, both with the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. So eventually we'll get there. Any questions?
Jeff?
Yes.
Yeah, there was, you know, I saw in a footnote regards to the bear with the three ribs in its mouth.
Uh-huh.
And I had in a footnote here that that these three ribs may represent the three principal conquests of Lydia in 546 BC, Babylon in 539, and Egypt in 525. That was one of my...
You press the camera.
I'll have to write that down. What were they? Lydia?
Lydia in 546 BC, Babylon in 539, and Egypt in 525.
Zoom.
Okay. I'll have to check that out. Thank you.
Jeff, you mentioned the toes on the statue that originally Nebuchadnezzar saw. Can you once again talk about that? You have the legs of iron, but then the toes, the 10 toes. What were you saying about that?
The 10 toes, well, the feet and the toes would be a future kingdom, distinct from the legs of iron, because the legs of iron immediately followed Greece. But the feet and toes could not immediately follow the Roman Empire because they were destroyed by the rock cut out without hands. So there has to be a time gap between the legs of iron representing ancient Rome and the feet of iron and clay, which are destroyed by the coming Messianic kingdom. You're muted.
Yeah. Okay. So, but I mean to say that they're 10 toes. Did you liken those to the 10 kingdoms that were?
I would liken them to the 10 kings, yes.
Okay.
Because they're, when Daniel is talking about this in chapter 7, when John portrays the 10 horns in chapter 12 and 13 and 17 in Revelation, they're all contemporaneous kings that are destroyed with the coming of the Messiah. So I would put the 10 toes with those 10 kings, yes.
Very good.
Jeff?
Yes.
Are there, who are the three kings that are deposed? The smaller horn comes up.
Don't know. We don't even know who the 10 horn, we don't know who the 10 kings are.
So when, after that, then there's only seven horns, right?
There's seven horns plus the little one, yes.
Plus the little one, yes.
Yep. And we don't know when, you know, when in the scheme of time the three horns are plucked up either.
Okay.
I remember years ago when the European Union was forming, everybody was saying, oh, those are the 10 horns. Right. And then it went up to, I don't know how many, 20, 25 nations. So that didn't work out. But maybe as it shrinks, it'll shrink down to 10.
And then seven.
And then seven, and yeah.
Well, we just got rid of the UK, so we're down to 23.
Yeah, I don't know how many are in the European Union.
Jeff, do you have an essay about the Antichrist versus the beast? And something one could study?
The Antichrist versus the beast in Revelation?
Yeah.
Well, the Antichrist is the beast. The beast in Revelation, it's portrayed as both the Antichrist and his kingdom. So in Revelation, there are actually two beasts. In chapter 13, the first half of the chapter, he presents the beast coming up out of the sea, which is the Antichrist, as well as his kingdom. And then in the second half of chapter 13, he sees the beast coming up out of the earth, which is the false prophet. So there's actually two beasts in Revelation. The Antichrist is always referred to as the beast, and the second beast out of the earth is referred to as the false prophet. Chapter 16, he does that, and chapter 19, he does that. So when you see the beast in Revelation, it's the Antichrist as well as his kingdom.
So Jeff, once again, the formation of Israel certainly, you know, it certainly is the beginning of prophetic events. I mean, I should say a significant occurrence in the prophetic events, in the sense that the establishment of the final phase before the millennial kingdom begins. It's one of the indicators.
Yeah, I would agree with that, but I'd be careful what passages you use to support that. I know some people like to use Ezekiel 37 and say, well, that was fulfilled in 1948. Ezekiel 37 was not fulfilled in 1948. In fact, Ezekiel 37 hasn't been fulfilled yet. So the Valley of Dry Bones and whatnot, that was not a recognition of Israel in 1948. The Valley of Dry Bones is not just a reconstitution of Israel or a revitalization of Israel. It's a restoration of Israel to the Lord. And that certainly did not happen in 1948. So while Israel, you know, regained a national identity and got a portion of their land back in 1948, it certainly does not fulfill Ezekiel 37.
Right, because Israel is apostate, right. Verses 37, which is life.
Right. So in 37, they've got life, they've got a restoration to the land, they've got a restoration to the Lord, and it even brings us to the second coming and a restoration of their kingdom, with David specifically mentioned as a king. So there's actually a resurrection in Ezekiel 37, and he does this again in Ezekiel 34. So Ezekiel 34, 37, Jeremiah 30, Hosea 3, they all talk about David being a king in the millennial kingdom, co-reigning with his descendant, the Messiah. So, you know, whatever we want to think about Ezekiel 37, it certainly was not fulfilled in 1948.
How about some pictures of beasts?
Yes, we need to see some beasts.
Debbie, show your picture. pull that up, buddy.
Okay. No, no,
great job, Devin.
That can grow.
Amazing.
And I like the bloody three horns coming out.
Wow.
That's great.
Good job, Devin.
Good job.
Good job.
Marissa, do you want to show?
Oh, here we go. All right, who else has? Okay, here we go.
Oh, the winged lion.
Oh, look at that.
Good job.
Nice.
That was nice. Wow.
Who did that?
Marissa.
I don't see her name on it.
Nice lion.
Good job.
She didn't want anyone to know.
Oh, okay. All right, looks like Love Day's got one. Love Day, you got one?
That is a scary one.
That's nice. Yikes.
All right.
Good job.
Love Day.
Hey, hang on, I gotta count the horns.
Cut it out.
I won't be able to sleep tonight.
You got a couple hours to recover.
It has 11 horns.
It's got 11 horns.
Put to work.
The one small one, the three haven't gone out yet.
Oh yeah, there we go, the lion.
Okay, who drew that?
That looks like Paddington.
Okay, anybody else?
That one's not Jonathan. Too frightening.
Oh, Jonathan, Rajan, let's...
Ooh, look at Jonathan, wow. Look at those feet.
Quite scary.
Wow, good job, Jonathan.
I like your neck for color.
Yeah.
Good job, Jonathan. Yeah,
like yours, Jonathan.
Whoa.
Oh, look at this guy. Ooh.
Look at that.
Nice job, Jacob.
Yeah, guys.
Good job, guys.
Surprise, we want you to sleep tonight.
Yeah.
The horns became hair after coloring, so.
Good job, guys.
Very hairy.
Any more?
I thought John Duckhorn
has one. Caden has one.
Where's John Duckhorn's picture?
Okay. Where's Caden's?
Look at that, Caden. Good job. Nice horns.
It all.
Good horns.
The horns coming out.
Wow. Let's see.
I started drawing one.
No, it's paid.
And after I couldn't do it. I got all kinds of. So I gave up.
Children can do it.
What kind of example is that, John?
Yeah. Children can draw pictures.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff, where's yours?
John, here's mine.
I showed you all mine.
You didn't draw those.
No. Where's yours?
I should have just put up the skunk that was in my backfield. I took a picture of.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's pretty nasty.
Here's Fred.
Okay, so next week we've got a ram and a shaggy goat
in chapter 8.
So you need to draw those pictures.
A ram, shaggy goat.
Trying to show this, but it wouldn't work because
they're coming together and they're going to butt heads. So you need to draw the pictures of them butting heads.
Oh. Okay.
All right, now Fred's trying to show his.
Not all the horns are nasty. Here's a benign horn that I've come up with.
Oh, come on, Fred.
That's a really? That's a duck horn.
I was thinking of doing something like that. Can you? But I couldn't.
That's either a duck horn.
That's a talking horn.
It has a few notes at the end.
That might be a lollipop.
Is that the little horn? Yeah, go ahead, kid.
Is that the little horn?
That's a easy way out, Fred. Oh, goodness.
Jeff, can you hear me?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Can you hear me, Jeff? No. Yeah. Have you ever heard of Dr. William McCarroll? Well, when I was in Bible school, that the class we had was Daniel and Revelation. And this guy taught at Moody and other schools. And when he was an old man, he used to come up on the train every week, one morning, from on the Milwaukee Road and teach Daniel and Revelation and then take the train back. And he was quite a Bible teacher in those days. Anyway, look for his name sometime, William McCarroll. Okay, that's all. Goodbye.
All right, so for prayer requests and schedule, I mentioned the ladies' meeting tomorrow morning at 9:30 on Zoom. Here's something you might be interested in, and that is the weekly CMML prayer time. They have 2 hours of prayer beginning at 8 o'clock, two sessions, one for men and one for women. If you'd like to join, I have the Zoom link. I'll forward it out.